David Flaherty, Marketing Director for Washington Wine, and this is Sommelite. Sommelite is a conversation series where we talk to some of our favorite wine pros from around the country, talk a little bit of shop, but more importantly, find out what makes them human and what makes them tick. I am super excited to welcome to the show today, Greg Rubin. Greg is the owner and corporate beverage director for two of the leading boutique wine shops in the country, Vanderbilt Ave Wine Merchants in Brooklyn, New York, and Horseneck Wine and Spirits in Greenwich, Connecticut. Prior to his career in wine, Greg spent time in consumer marketing and digital brand strategy, mainly in the music and entertainment industry. He worked in sales and marketing at Jive Records, Sony Music, for artists such as Britney Spears, Pink, Usher, and Justin Timberlake, among others. He found his love of wine through restaurant cooking, is a certified sommelier, and holds an MBA from NYU's Stern School of Business. Greg, it's awesome to see you. First off, how are you and where are you?
Good to see you too. I am in Greenwich, Connecticut at Horseneck right now, and I'm good. I'm good. Everything's been really busy, so I can't complain.
Before we go any further, I got to know, who's the most fun to hang out with? Britney Spears, Pink, Usher, or Justin Timberlake? And follow-up question, if you could go to Northern Italy with just one of them and just you, who would it be?
Well, I wish I could say I hung out with them, but in the lovely world of record labels, they don't really like hanging out at the label so much. So, but I will say that of all the people I worked with, T-Pain was probably the most fun to hang out with. He enjoyed hanging out at the office. So if I had to go to Northern Italy, I might actually want to go with T-Pain. I feel like he would dig it there. We could geek out on some wines. It would definitely be a good time.
I love it. T-Pain, not an option, but a good option. And if you've not
second seen... option of the set you gave me, I would probably say Timberlake.
Timberlake, I like it. I like T-Pain better. That's a better option. And if you've seen the show on Netflix, I think it's called This Is Pop Music.
I have not watched it.
There is an episode on auto-tune all about T-Pain and his use of auto-tune. It's kind of incredible.
He's awesome. He's amazing. I loved working all his albums. And yeah, we used to have this one office at the label that was empty. And we would save it for when any of our artists were coming through. And most of them never took us up on it. But he always did. And he would go and hang out there with his buddies and his manager and whoever else he had in tow. And I probably shouldn't blow up his spot. But let's just say, like, things went down in that office that probably didn't go on in most skyscrapers in New York.
I love it. Yeah. We'll say hi to T-Pain for me.
I sure will.
You guys are out there on the flight. Now, we're going to talk a lot about wine and your journey to get to wine, but I got to ask you about two things on your resume before we proceed.
Uh-oh.
Apparently, you spent many years working with the Contemporary Acapella Society in San Francisco and also
yes,
the Massachusetts Horticulture Society. So
I did.
Are you both an acapella singer and a gardener?
You're killing me early on this. Yes, so I did acapella in college. And then there's an organization called the Contemporary Acapella Society, and it does a bunch of education programs. It also throws like weekend-long festivals around the country. So I got involved with them after college to help them, you know. I joined to run marketing for them and then ended up running it. I was there during, like, I don't know if you remember it, but there was a show, a reality show competition on NBC. I think it was called The Sing-Off. And it was on right around when like Pitch Perfect came out. So I was running the show, running CASA during that whole thing, during the heyday of acapella. I guess that's partly why I found music, because I was coming out of college and I had recorded a couple albums with the acapella group and did some other stuff. And I was like, man, I really want to get into the music industry. So that was, I don't know. That's what I chose that I wanted to do. And then, yeah, the Mass Horticulture Society. So they have this beautiful campus outside of Boston across the Charles River from where I grew up. And so it's like this 80-acre campus that the state leases to them for like $1 a year. And they have all these trial gardens and all this cool stuff. But they also have this unbelievable defunct Georgian mansion on property. And it fell into disrepair. It's vacant. They don't know what to do with it. So I joined because I pitched them on turning it into a Blue Hill at Stone Barns type concept. And so we got kind of far down the road with it. We went and met with Stone Barns and got a lot of like how the sausage was made down there. to get that up and running. And we'll see. It's kind of like fits and starts up there, but that was why I joined up with them, is to try to get the whole property turned into something.
That's amazing. I would ask you to do some a cappella for us.
You'd have to ploy me with far more wine.
But yes, as a former actor who was asked like many times at Thanksgiving dinners and stuff, you know, like right when it's a couple glasses of wine deep and, you know, there's like a lull in the conversation. And then like, someone's like, "Hey Dave, why don't you do some Shakespeare for us?"
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like kind of die into your chair a little bit. So I will not ask you to do acapella on the show, but I am going to call you afterwards. And you can
do your internet sleuthing, and maybe I'm sure you'll find something out there.
You shouldn't have said that.
Challenge.
I will find it.
Challenge has been thrown. So
challenge accepted.
Yeah.
We will be posting some links, everybody, to Greg's a cappella performances.
It was nice knowing everybody in the wine industry. I'm going to go crawl into a hole for the next 30 years.
We're going to send that to the horse neck mailing list next week. So let's jump back, because you've had a pretty interesting range of careers, actually, before you came to wine. And, you know, it's one thing to appreciate and collect wine. It's another to leave your career behind, especially later in life.
Yes.
And jump into this is a career. So tell us how that happened.
So I always loved food and wine. I grew up, you know, leafing through Jacques Pepin cookbooks and watching Galloping Gourmet, and just always loved food. I would cook. Basically, if I stayed home from school, after I watched, you know, The Price is Right and 3 other hours of television, my mom would say, you know, go do something. And I would just go like find a page in Jacques Pepin's cookbook and cook something. So in college, I got a job over the summer cooking, loved it, trailed at Tabla as a potential first job out of college. But long story short, like I couldn't make the rent based on what they were going to pay me in the kitchen. And I didn't know anybody in New York. So I turned it down and went into the music industry and very much the corporate side of things. I started at Sony Music. Actually, before that, I was at Accenture. That was my first job in New York. That's how I got to be able to move to New York. And at Accenture, you can bank all of your paid time off. So they give you whatever it was, 5 weeks a year. And if you didn't use it up, it all banked for the following year. So the second year I was there, I had like 8 or 9 weeks of vacation banked out. And a friend of mine was running a summer program at a school in Switzerland. And he said, "Hey, I don't know if you'd want to come, but like, it's kind of a blast to come work here for the summer. I can pay you basically enough to keep, you know, you can live for free while you're here, but that's it." Like, you know what? Sure. Great. So I took my whole like 9 weeks or whatever it was, and I worked at this school in Switzerland, and it was an hour and a half or 2 hours from Burgundy. So like we lived up above some of the crew vineyards in the Val region. So we would like bike in and eat Chasselas grapes off the farmer's vines when they weren't looking, and then take weekend trips into Burgundy. And I started to learn wine that way. And I did that another summer and left Accenture, went into the music industry. You know, it's funny because my dream was to be in the music industry and like to go to the Grammys, and I got to do that, and to like make platinum albums, which I got to do. Like I did all the things that in my mind was my dream or my love, I guess. But at a certain point, I realized that there's a fine line between being in love with something and being seduced by it. And I think I was seduced by the music industry, and doing it day to day was not, I didn't love it. So I was like, God, what am I going to do? Maybe it's because I work for a giant company. You know what? I'm going to go to business school, kind of reset, go work for a small company. So I did that. I went to work for this really cool small consulting firm. And one of my main clients was Microsoft. And I had worked for Microsoft while I was at Accenture, but we did a client appreciation dinner every year at the Herb Farm in Woodinville. And I realized at like the second or third time I did this, I realized I was spending more time in the wine cellar at the Herb Farm than I was like at the table schmoozing clients.
And it's a great wine cellar too.
It's a great wine cellar. And yeah, so I had this feeling of like, you know, this whole corporate thing just still isn't sitting right with me. I don't feel like I'm in my groove doing this. Like I'm quote unquote successful. I have a good job. And I, you know, my company I worked for was awesome. We did such cool work. But it just didn't like day to day really fulfill me. Around that same time, my dad got really sick with ALS. I was helping my mom care for him, and he was like, he was successful in his life, and he had this feeling like he, despite his success, he, I don't know, he seemed unsatisfied or unfulfilled. And I had this feeling like, you know, watching kind of him decline, and I was like, you know, what am I doing? I'm wasting my time just not being in my groove. Like, it sounds really, really cheesy, but I remember I was watching a video of Jim Carrey giving a graduation speech, and he said, it's, I'm going to totally botch this or at least paraphrase it, but he said something along the lines of like, it's so easy to fail at the things you don't love. You might as well fail at the thing you love. So I already had this in my mind. And then, so I got laid off from my job. I think I was spending too much time caring for my dad and I wasn't like in it. And I'm like, okay, this is a sign. Like, I got to reevaluate here. Like, I'm not going to go back and do that. And so over the years I had developed this love of wine. I had attended some auctions and bought like the cheapest bottles available, gone to Burgundy a few times. And so that was kind of the impetus for it. And an opportunity popped up to purchase what's now Vanderbilt Ave Wine Merchants. And it's such a small store. I was like, you know, I could take my kind of digital marketing background I had developed in my corporate life and apply it to wine. I was like, you know, at the time, there aren't really any great online wine experiences. You know, I couldn't think of a store that was really doing an A-plus job with online sales. I was like, all right, if I could do just a little bit better than the next guy with the digital side of the business, I could maybe do something here. So that that's so
prescient.
That's a somewhat long story, not the longest version, but yeah.
Because I was going to ask you that, like, you know, you saying that really like strikes home, because that's really what the last year and a half has been for so many people. Yes. And wineries, wine shops, like, oh crap, we're not involved in the digital landscape. We got to like catch up fast because it didn't need to be. But that's interesting that you were in there so early on that. But that's kind of going to lead into my next question, which was, you know, one advantage it seems from my seat is you having done such a varied, you know, diverse set of skills with these other careers, you know, then to come to wine without this like just wine track for your whole life. You know, what are some of those skills that you found beneficial that you pulled forward from those other careers that you're still using today?
Well, I definitely think the grass is always greener on the other side, because I sit here and I'm like, gosh, I don't have the 15, 20 years of coming up through restaurants or importers, or, you know, people talk about all these producers that have done X, Y, and Z 15, 20 years ago. And, you know, there's days where I'm like, I can understand why somebody looks at me and is like, this guy like jumped into an industry he had no business getting into and like jumped the line a little bit, you know? Nobody says, no.
Is that generated?
Totally not. It's my own, like you got the two things on your shoulder, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of the fraud complex, like you.
Yeah, totally. But that drives me to like constantly be learning, like listen, ask questions, ask too many questions, write things down, just learn, because I always feel like I do like this, but I never feel like I'm the smartest person in the room, and I don't ever want to be, but this is certainly a case where like a lot of people have a lot more experience time-wise in the wine industry than I do. But anyway, yeah. So that said, there are definitely things from my time that I think hopefully helped me. Certainly like the marketing and kind of advertising and branding side of things. You know, I did a big project when I was for the small consulting firm. We did a project for General Motors, and they really wanted to know what drove millennials to buy a car. They had a problem understanding young consumers. And we did this like crazy analytical project, like tons of surveys and data, you know, I was like a data scientist. And so we learned a lot about consumer behavior, latent needs, meaning things that emotional drives you have that you don't realize drive you to make a purchase. And so doing that, I was really kind of keeping that in my mind as I started wrapping my head around like what makes a great wine retail experience. And the thing I kind of landed on is that, and maybe everybody's realized this already, but it's an important thing for me to keep in mind, is we're really just selling trust, and we're in the business of risk reduction. That most people, when they're buying wine, whether it's retail or at a restaurant, are scared as hell. They don't know what word to use. They don't know if what they're buying is, they're going to overspend. They're bringing the bottle to a party, and they don't know if it's like something the host is going to want to drink.
They don't know how to pronounce it.
They don't know how to pronounce
it. Absolutely.
What do I do when the somm hands me the cork? Why is the cork still on the table?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm fiddling with it too much. You know, there's constant anxiety and risk involved with purchasing wine. And so doing some of that work around these latent need type things, it sounds really like you're engineering a human experience, but I think that was really important to me in developing kind of the brand of our stores.
So let's take that from like, you know, data analysis,
sure,
theoretical approach to like practicality, like when you're in your store and now your second store, mm-hmm. how does that live out? Like if I'm a millennial or I'm somebody intimidated by wine, how are you actively breaking down those barriers?
One of the things we do, which is we've been able to do it less during COVID because we haven't had as many in-store sales experiences, but there's a concept in statistics called discrete choice. So like one of the projects I did for Microsoft was they wanted to know what features to offer on all of their products to various size businesses. And so we did a survey where it was like, okay, you're buying this package. How do you want to mix all the various optional features? And we would give them these discrete choices. So they couldn't pick all the options. They could choose between 1 to 4 different versions. And then there's a whole bunch of statistical analysis that goes on in the background afterwards that kind of teases out what the most important, or it values all of those pieces depending on some variables. So the way we apply that is, first of all, I try to not have too many options for each category of wine. So I don't want 30 Sancerres. I don't want 15 Pinot Grigios all between $15 and $20. The discrete is really the operative word there, that there needs to be a small set of choices because you don't want to overwhelm somebody. And then what we do, let's say you come in, right, and you say, you're a kind of traditional wine buyer. You're not knowledgeable. You don't know how to pronounce things. You're like, I need to buy a bottle because I'm going to somebody's house. Great. Red or white? So right there, we've cut the universe in half, right? Maybe red. Okay, perfect. What, you know, where do you want to stay? 30, 20? Okay, now we've cut the universe down even more. Then what we do is we put 3 options up and we give the elevator pitch on all 3. 10 to 15 words on each. And then we kind of stand back. And a lot of the time they take all 3.
Huh.
Yeah.
Just say. That's great. I love that.
Like, we're really fortunate that I've designed Vanderbilt and the way that that store works, and then the way that Horseneck already worked, is it's very much a hand sell type experience. We hand sell most of the bottles we sell. So we can do that. You know, if we were in a more traditional, like just grab and go type setting, it wouldn't work.
I often hear other people, and like I sometimes fall into this trap as well, where you're like, you know, one day when I get older, I'm going to open a wine shop in a little town by the sea.
Sure.
You know, just kind of disappear and have a little business.
Right.
But I think it's fair to say retail wine, selling wine is much more difficult than people think. You've learned a lot now. Looking back to when you started, what are like the 3 biggest things you would tell yourself at the start of your career, if you could go back, about selling wine in a retail shop?
Oh man. That is a great question.
And you have 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Three, And these better be it. You're locking these in gold.
I can't forever. Go back. No, I know.
You can't.
It tells you how much time I've spent thinking about where I'm at and where it's come from. It's more like I'm just trying to steer the ship still.
Yeah, you're just
I think one of the things is, you know, so when I started, I had one employee who was there maybe 30 hours a week, and then I was there the rest, you know, all the time. One store, no wine club, no online. That's not true. I had online, but it was small. And I never saw my kids. And I would walk back. So we lived in Connecticut. We actually moved back to Brooklyn when I opened the store at Vanderbilt Ave, with a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old and a wife who was kind of nodding along and saying, sure, if this is what you want, let's do it. And I would walk back after closing up at night, and I'd see everybody in their brownstones enjoying dinner and watching TV together and having fun. And I'd be the guy still trudging through the snow on the way home. And there were nights where I really hated that. You know, I hated not being part of the world, you know, just having my own thing. But most of the time I loved it. And I think I would look back and tell myself those were really good times, that it was a tiny business and it wasn't enough to support the family at that point, which we knew that's how it would be. But man, it's just so nice to sit in the shop and chat with people and find bottles and taste cool wines. And, you know, I tell people, like, running a wine shop is running an adult candy store, because most people, if you're doing your job right, most people leave happy no matter what day they had. And so it's very, very fulfilling to do that every few minutes during the day. Way better than sitting in a corporate office trying to convince the, you know, CMO of Amex that he should, you know, do this, that, or the other thing.
Yeah. Have you now found, I'll let you throw another one out there.
I got two more for you. Yeah, actually, yeah. I don't know if I have two more.
I asked for three.
Well, so now there's two stores. I have more than one employee for sure. You know, I have a bunch of employees, two different states, two different regulators.
How many employees do you have now, Greg?
9, I think. I'd have to think. We actually had our first all company hangout, both stores, everybody together at my house a month ago, which was awesome. It's still really fulfilling. It's really cool that I have so many people working here, and that people are, like, you know, getting married, buying homes, moving forward in life, and partially because of the work we're doing and the fact that, you know, the business is healthy. So that's really fulfilling. Every year when I would get together with the staff, especially the Brooklyn crew, the younger people, I would tell them, look, if you're here with me in 20 years, that's awesome. I'm assuming you won't be. All that I can ask is that you go on and you do cool stuff, because the real mark of success here is that when I'm, you know, having my cheesy retirement party in however many years, that I look back on everybody that's come through and worked here, and they're all off doing really cool things. You know, like, think about, like, Paul and Terroir, like, how many people like you have come through there and are off doing cool stuff. Like, that's really the mark of a great business, a great manager. And so that's starting to happen now. You know, I've got somebody off making wine with Clos Aaron in California now. I have a couple other folks that are making their own wine. I mean, that part's really cool. And I don't know if I would tell my year one self anything about that, but it's nice to be here a few years down the road and seeing those things start to actually take shape.
I got two. I mean, I want that third.
The third is I should have paid more attention in accounting class. That's what it is.
Really? I mean, but yeah. That surprises me, because you know, you have an MBA in business.
Yeah, but accounting is only one class.
From one of the greatest business schools in the country.
Accounting is only one class.
Okay,
fair. And you don't really have to know much more than that semester to get the business school.
I heard that actually from a friend who actually, you know, that I used to work with as well in restaurants, that now has kind of gone off and done her thing, like you just mentioned. And she owns a wine shop now. And she said that another friend that owns a wine shop, her advice was basically all that you do as a wine shop owner, the two things that you need to know are Excel sheets and breaking down cardboard.
Ha! Yeah. Yeah.
But focus on the Excel. And that it does come so much down to numbers. Like how much is that a big piece of retail? Sort of understand the numbers, because you know, you're making prices, you've got wines that people see out in the market other places. So you know there's a price awareness of those wines that you have to be careful of. You know,
I
now
think it depends on the business dynamics of your own store. Like if you were talking to the head of Total Wine, the numbers matter in a different way to them, and or you know, any large store. But as a smaller store, you know, certain things matter more than other. Like I'm more concerned with the quote unquote numbers than I am about getting the largest allocation I can of X, Y, and Z.
Let's talk numbers, because you know, a lot of people that listen to the show are in the biz, and
yeah.
You know, a lot of sommeliers in particular on the restaurant floor, or you know, people that work in sales or distribution, it's so much comes down to numbers. And it's great to like get swept up in the romance of wine and the storytelling of wine. That's all great and good.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, this is a nickel and dime business. Things have to add up. The percentages have to make sense.
Yes.
Are you approaching pricing with a pretty like broad brush, like everything gets a markup of X, or
No.
Are you getting pretty creative and playing around with how you price things and how you move product through your stores?
Yeah, it definitely depends. It's in a way, it's almost like each case is its own pricing puzzle to figure out. So you got to remember, like I have New York and I have Connecticut. Connecticut, all the wholesalers are required to price frontline. There's no deep buys in Connecticut. It's all one case pricing. In New York, there's deep buys. In addition, my Connecticut store is only 2 miles from the New York line, and there's a store right over the line. So when I price Veuve Clicquot, for example, in Connecticut, I have to look at what they've priced it at that New York store, because they're buying the 25 case buy. So for my Connecticut store, Veuve Clicquot is a loss leader. There's also other rules, like there's minimum pricing in Connecticut and there's not in New York. So we can price that however we want in New York, but we have a minimum price we legally can't go below in Connecticut. So there's those. So there's some state to state regulatory issues, but yeah, I mean, it's a highly competitive business, and we've talked about this before, but I like trying to tease out whether or not wine is a commodity or a luxury good, because it depends on what you're selling. Like if it's something that there's no competition on, then in a way it's a luxury good. But if it's Veuve Clicquot, it's a commodity. And even with some of the luxury wines, depending on your customer, they might see it as a commodity because they get offered it. I mean, I have customers that to them, DRC is a commodity. They know the going price of DRC, and I cannot deviate from that or they won't buy it. And, you know, it's an interesting challenge. It's one of the nice benefits of having the selection we have at Vanderbilt Ave is that those are such small production wines that, yes, there's competition, but it's very localized. It's only a handful of retailers around the country that work those wines. So it's not like we're going to go gouge everybody. I don't, you know, that's not the business we run, but we are able to like make a regular margin on some of those wines so that we can offer better service, you know, more better delivery options, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, they're not seeing that same wine in every spot they got.
No. Right? And your question about like,
restaurant.
Does it matter? Like or how important are the numbers, and it's a nickel and dime business. I mean, I keep a spreadsheet of all of my monthly financials, every single cost line. I keep probably way more of a complicated analysis on inventory management monthly than I probably maybe need to. But again, like, you know, this whole business is bootstrapped. I don't have investors. I don't have some massive line of credit. So the number, like it sounds trite, but you really kind of have to count pennies a little bit.
With your background in music and in the entertainment industry, a lot of people, musicians, artists, they came to you for your marketing knowledge. You know, how do we make a splash? How do we get attention? How do we take this cool project that we're doing and get people to pay, you know, look at it, right? Yep. I mean, that's the wine world in a nutshell. You've got, I think it's like last count was like 10,000 plus wineries just in the United States alone. And then when you look at like how many SKUs each one of those wineries has, you know, it's a ton of wine and it's a ton of different, you know, individual items to sell. So marketing is very important.
Mm-hmm.
What are you seeing from your seat, you know, with a marketing background that's outside of wine? Like, how important is marketing for a winery? And what would you advise are some of the things that they need to most focus on?
Well, you get what you pay for. And since I'm not being paid for this advice, it's not going to be very good. So one of the things I'll say is that the record label acts more or less, like if I had to say that the record label is like this in the wine industry, it's most like a distributor, because there's a portfolio of wines that, and the distributor is known for having a certain style of wine or a certain genre of music for the label. So one of the things that would happen at Jive is we would have weekly marketing meetings. And so it was all the senior vice presidents and then the Barry Weiss, the head of the label. And every week there'd be an agenda printed out and it would be whatever albums were being worked on at the time. So if Britney was working on an album and Usher and whoever, and it was always the biggest artists were on the front page of the agenda with big font, lots of bullet items. And then on the back page, tiny little bullets would be our up and coming acts, you know? And almost invariably every week, most of the time would be spent on the first page and then they kind of rush through the last agenda. I'm sure this happens with you guys with your meetings too, is that the last bullet points never get any love.
Right.
And so, you know, we'd have these artists that would be sending demos and be trying to sign up for the label. And, you know, our A&R people would advise them like, look, you're not ready. Like you're going to get lost in the shuffle. And so one of the things I would tell more of an up and coming winery is be careful who you think you want to work with may not be who would be best for you. Because yeah, you want the big, great art, you know, great book of fine wines to distribute you nationally. But what if nobody takes your bottles out? What if you're not getting, you know, yeah, maybe you get a slot in the sales meeting to go, you know, zoom in and do a virtual presentation, but then what? You know, what after that? So
I love that equivalent, you know, to like music and the producer.
Well, it's the same thing. Artist. It's like with Jive, right? Like Jive was known for a lot of hip hop and pop, just, you know, JT, Britney, Usher, Outkast. We had a bunch of sub labels that did like all the up and coming, like Atlanta rap, Texas, all this stuff. But you can't just be a hip hop label or a pop label. It's like, what else? You can't just be, I mean, I guess you could be just Australian wines or whatever, but you have to hedge your bets a little bit. You have to diversify. People need a Malbec, people need a whatever it is. So it's the same idea of how do you construct this portfolio and then how do you give all of your artists or all of your wineries love? I don't envy that job as a distributor. That's a really, really tough job.
That is a really tough job. You know, and what that does is that leaves, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of wineries left to their own devices to sell their own wine.
Just like musicians.
Yeah. And in a way, maybe that's fine because you might make 2,000 cases, 3,000 cases a year. You're not looking to be in 20 states, let alone 10 states. But talk to me about, from a marketing perspective, like storytelling. That's so important for wine. It's, you know, sommeliers do it on the floor. You do it every day in the retail shop. Like, how do you talk to your employees? How do you approach that when you're trying to pull a bottle off the shelf and nobody knows what's in it and you're trying to sell it?
Yeah, I think the storytelling obviously is more important for hand sales and retail and on the floor for somms. I think it really comes down to knowing your audience. And I guess maybe you would, with a marketing background, you would expect that I would have this like nice framework for employees, like a handbook of how to sell a bottle, you know, first do this, then do this. And I don't, I mean, it's really, I try to hire for that skill. I think there's an innate sense some people have for being able to read their audience. And you know, sure. Do we look for clues? Do I try to train folks on what signals to pick up, of course, but a lot of it comes down to knowing your audience. You know, with storytelling, especially with some of the smaller, more natural producers, there's a lot of different types of things you can say. You know, you can talk about where the grapes are, the terroir of the wine itself, like what's actually in the bottle. You can talk about the people that are making the wine and how cool they and fun they are and how they have a three-legged dog that runs around the winery with you or whatever. You know, you can talk about the winemaking practices and that they, you know, they don't char their barrels. They expose them to heated rocks and it caramelizes, you know, whatever it is, which is true. There are winemakers that are doing that. There's lots, and knowing if you go down the wrong path, the customer or the guest is going to tune out and you only have a little bit of time to really capture them. You can talk about the price and the value. So I think a lot of reading your audience is knowing what path to take, which of the stories in your mind about that wine you should tell. I mean, we do this with our emails, our weekly emails, especially out of Vanderbilt Ave. We make a point of doing one, maybe two emails a week, no more. And they're well-researched. I think they're great. They're super informative. And they're usually about a producer that's very interesting. But we have a hard time shutting up. You know, we have a hard time not putting stuff in, or, you know, saying, okay, we don't need to say this. I think as wine professionals, we love and are super passionate about pretty much everything that goes into making wine. And at the end of the day, we just don't need to tell people all of it. We need to say whatever it is our customer is going to be most enthralled with. I wish I had a better answer than that, but that's like, you know, it really is about reading the guest and saying, I bet you they're going to geek out on the terroir. I bet you they're going to just love hearing what it tastes like or love hearing our own passion. I mean, a lot of times I'll sell a bottle just because I love it. I love this wine. And I'll tell people that, like, I love this wine and you may not be like me or maybe you are, but that gets people excited sometimes.
Yeah. And maybe that's all you need to say sometimes, but you know, you said earlier, and my hunch is that you earn that respect, you earn that position, which
you
is
definitely have to earn it.
You're selling trust, right? And that at a certain point you have clientele or other influential people in the wine world that sell wine, be it a salesperson for a great portfolio. You know, they come in and you just cut right to the chase and they're like, look, you know me, I know you, I'm not gonna beat around the bush. This is an insane wine, you gotta get it. And sometimes they're just like, done. You know, same with the sommelier at the table. It's like, I've come in here 1,000 times. I've been in here for dinners with my clients. I've been here for dinners with my family.
Right.
Just tell me what to drink, right? It comes to the point where you just reach that trust. So without getting too analytical, how do you get people to trust you?
Well, I think you first have to conduct your business honestly. You know, you don't play pricing games. I try not to push exclusivity about, you know, well, it's only, you know, I only have, or what, I mean, sure. Sometimes that's true. But I think you just have to be an honest person and come across as that. Treat your employees well. One of the big elements of trust is somebody who comes back and sees the same face again and again. And if you're not treating your employees well, you're going to have a lot of turnover and there's going to be a lot of new faces all the time and a lot of new faces that don't themselves exude trust and confidence and, you know, and all of the things you're trying to sell. So that's really, really important to me. I think it should be important to anybody selling trust, selling wine. The other big part of this that wine really benefits from is what in the parlance of marketing theory is called badge marketing. So this would be anything that you can attach to your brand that helps position your brand or define your brand. So an appellation would be a badge. A restaurant, a Michelin star is a badge, quite literally for some folks. So, you know, to say it's Russian River Pinot matters to folks. That's really the genius of appellations, is it's a badge of trust.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the race now, right? I mean, you see it in Oregon, you see it in Washington, you know, newer regions, we're at 19 AVs.
Yeah, you just got some new ones, right?
Yeah. And I think that's the goal eventually is that you can drop the name of the AVA and that immediately in someone's mind goes, oh, like that's the badge of quality. That's the badge of trust. That's the badge of like kick-ass wine.
Yeah. I mean, you see like rock star winemakers now have their own badge, right? You, oh, well, this is, you know, so-and-so made this wine, right? And oh, wow. Okay. So it must be good.
John Bon Jovi, man, selling a lot of that Hampton water. I don't know.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if you carry that in your store.
One of his main investors is a resident in Greenwich and a customer. So
I bet. Of course we have it. I know. Great. I know they sell a lot of that wine and it makes a lot of people happy. So you run two stores, arguably in two places of the world that couldn't be more different. Mm-hmm. Prospect Heights, Brooklyn and Greenwich, Connecticut. How important is it for a wine shop to connect to its local community? And how do you approach featuring what wines you like and then balancing that with what wines the clientele likes?
So I don't know how important it is for a wine store in general to connect with the community. I can tell you that for us, it's very important. You know, the Greenwich store, this store has been here since Prohibition was repealed. And so it, you know, 85 years, and it's always been in this one location. It's never moved. I'm only the third owner. So it's almost built in here that we've connected to the community. You know, we take part in a lot of the nonprofit fundraising events and town parties and things like that. And it's critical for sure. But the bigger question and the really the million-dollar question is, how do you balance give the customer what they want and getting them to get into the stuff you're into too? And, you know, my Brooklyn shop is not a great example of give the customer what they want, because what they want is also what we want. And so it kind of matches up perfectly. You know, I don't think my staff or I really drink New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. I don't think we've ever sold a single bottle of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc in that store ever.
Wow.
And that's probably amazing. Won't. And part of that's just because like I lived in Brooklyn for a decade before moving out, you know, and where if I never had kids, I probably would still live there maybe. And so it's very much like, you know, a store crafted in the image of the people that live around it. It's also a lot of people that live in that area are at that age where you're starting to get into wine and you don't know what you don't know. You don't have the spectrum of wine already built out for you. And so we're getting customers at the time when they're still learning what that spectrum is, of all the way from California cab that is made in, you know, to be a very specific taste with no, like you said, no story behind it, just it tastes good, all the way to the super crazy, you know, tiny producer nobody's ever heard of making cab in a really weird way, right? So we have them at a time when we can help them learn things, and then their lexicon, their palate, their spectrum is built around what we already like. In Connecticut, we have people that already have this idea of what wine is. And that's really the crux of how we solve that problem. It's a little bit like, it actually kind of goes back to the record label example. I would say most wine buyers listen to pop music. You know, they drink Napa Cab, they drink Russian River Pinot, they drink, and I'm being really reductive here. I know this is not like a perfect example of
No, you roll. I like it. Go ahead.
Yeah. But like in broad strokes, right? If you're going to reduce this down to something, I think this kind of works, right? So like, it's very pop music. Why does it work? Because it tastes good. Why does pop music work? Well, it's a 1-4-5-1 chord progression. The melody resolves. It gives you anticipation. It gratifies that anticipation with resolution on a tonic chord, like all this stuff, right? It's the same thing. It's why Tropicana orange juice tastes good. But there's jazz music. There's Poulenc for like really weird atonal classical music. There's Tool, there's Radiohead. You know, there's all this other stuff. So that's kind of the idea, is like, how do we find things that aren't 1-4-5-1 pop music but that can still be enjoyable to somebody where like that's mostly what they've been listening to or mostly what they've been drinking. And so that's at least to me, like how I try to solve that puzzle for the more traditional wine drinker.
Yeah, you have to find that like familiar ground that they understand before you can move them to ground that's
totally new. It's like you're not going to go throw like the most atonal, you know, Thelonious Monk jazz on them if they first haven't listened to Coltrane or Miles Davis or Rubeck or whatever, or even the blues, right? Like you got to give them something to ladder them into. And maybe they never listen to Thelonious. Maybe they never drink Closeron or something, you know, that's really kind of out there taste-wise. I mean, that's really the big difference is I think you know, having the Connecticut store is really grounding for us. And I have everybody at Vanderbilt Ave come and work in the Connecticut store a little bit too.
Oh, that's so smart. Because
it's, I mean, our Brooklyn store is such a unique, you know, it is not a at a central casting for wine store. And I think it's really grounding to remember how most people approach wine. And, you know, and that's really, that's kind of what we have to remember that. We have to remember that that most people are not listening to Thelonious Monk. And maybe they don't want, maybe for most people, taste is what drives everything else. And if it doesn't taste good, they're not going to drink it, even if the story is incredible. You know, we work with a Piedmont producer in Brooklyn called Fabio Gaia. He's this really eccentric guy in Barbaresco. He does the stone. He doesn't toast his barrels. He exposes them to volcanic rocks that have been heated up. The wines are amazing. They're beautiful. They're polished. They're pristine. But they're a little out. Some of those wines are really out there taste-wise. And I got them registered in Connecticut because I really wanted to work them here at Horseneck. And I thought, you know, again, with the badge marketing, like it's Barbaresco. Like at least people can wrap their heads around the structure of the Barbaresco appellation, the age requirements, the farming requirement, you know, all of that. And so we registered those and I sent an offer out. Really not, I had no idea what to expect. I really thought this thing was going to be a total shelf turd. Like nobody was going to wrap their head. They'd try a bottle and be like, it just doesn't taste good. I still have people coming and asking for more of it. And which was surprising because, you know, I guess it kind of validates those wines and what I'm thinking about of like laddering people from a more traditional taste or palate into some of the more eccentric stuff. But yeah, I'm rambling a little bit, but that's, like I said, I think to remember that most people's palate is used to this one thing. And really the taste governs a lot of everything else for most people.
Yeah, I love that, man. I actually really like those metaphors. I like that laddering people up, laddering people to the side, you know, laddering people out, but you got to start.
One of the ways that I would talk about it, it's like you've, especially with the more natural, kind of more wild wines, there's the shallow end of the pool and the deep end of the pool. Mm-hmm. Like, as long as you're swimming in the pool, you're good, right? Like, we'll give you some shallow end of the pool. You tell me if you want to wade any deeper or not.
Yep.
But no judgment either way. You know?
I love it. That's Thelonious and the pool.
A lot of I mixed some metaphors in there. There's some baseball in there. We could
jazz in the pool.
Whatever.
Baseball. Yeah. We're gonna switch it up a little bit, Greg. We're gonna do some rapid fire questions for you. All right. Here we go. Have you ever had a nickname?
Yes.
What is the nickname?
Although my probably the top one is just Rubes. Rubes.
I like mm-hmm. it. What brings you joy right now?
Spending time with my kids. I know that is super cheesy, but it's true. That definitely brings me joy.
As a dad, I understand.
You get it. Yeah.
No cheese factor here.
Yeah.
I'll let other people interpret the cheese. What's your bedtime routine?
Not much. Brush teeth, get into bed, throw on a podcast, earbuds in, fall asleep. I fall asleep to a podcast every night.
What podcast do you fall asleep to?
It changes up. I listen to Sean Carroll, who does a science podcast. I listen to Guild Psalm every now and then. I listen to some true crime stuff, but not to fall asleep. That'd be twisted.
Totally. Dateline.
I'm kind of a science geek, you know, like I did a lot of statistics. So I'll listen to anybody who's an expert on like quantum mechanics, quantum gravity, weird like mathematic fields of study, stuff like that.
Sleep like a baby.
That is just music to my ears.
Turn on the quantum physics.
Oh, it's like Mother Goose for a 40-year-old. It's great.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
What's your go-to non-alcoholic drink?
I have tea a lot at night. I drink tea at night, and at the end of dinner, I'll often have tea. But at a bar or something, I usually have a Shirley Temple, believe it or not.
Really? I love
Why that. Not? It's great.
It's a delicious drink.
It's delicious. Why did we stop drinking them? Just because we're old.
Oh my God. I'm going to
go have one. Yeah. Go have a Shirley Temple.
I'm going to do that the next time I go out, just to watch the bartender's reaction.
You're going to smile when you drink it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the longest you've gone without sleep and why?
This is a good story. I went 3.5 days without sleep because I was pledging a society in college, and it wasn't like a semester long.
Was this the acapella society?
Yeah. There were a few acapella geeks in there, but no, it was an arts society. It was a lot of poets and painters, and there may or may not have been cannabis being passed around frequently.
And you still stayed asleep for 3.5 days.
Yeah, exactly. But the initiation was not like a full semester of things. It was one long weekend where you basically don't sleep.
And you read poetry in a cave.
It was actually, you know, it was a fast. I can't divulge all of the things that they swear you to secrecy. But I will say one at the very end of the long weekend, they have you look in a mirror. And it was actually really interesting because you're so sleep deprived that like, all your guard, all your ego, like you're just so gassed that there's no ego, there's no nothing. It's really interesting to look at yourself with none of that. There, you really, it was like, wow, I'm really seeing myself.
This is like hazing.
I don't think I've ever told that story. Yeah.
This is like the best hazing I've ever heard. It's like, now look into your real self.
Yeah, totally. It was cool.
I love that.
It was cool.
That's better than like drink, 40 ounces of green spirit. And
it's not so bad.
That's now look in the mirror.
It's a time and a place. Yeah. Now look in the mirror.
What is more cute, bunnies or pandas?
Baby pandas or regular sized pandas?
Ooh, I didn't think about baby pandas, but if
you're regular, welcome. If it's regular sized pandas, I got to go bunnies.
What about, okay, baby bunnies versus baby pandas?
I think,
in the world of animals, as soon as you add in baby anything, it's immediately a, cuteness factor quotient of 20.
Totally. Well, here's the question. What would you rather fight? 20 bunny sized pandas or one panda sized bunny?
I would go with the 20 bunny sized pandas all day.
I think I would too.
I just don't feel like they have the developed teeth or potentially the fangs to do much.
Do they have claws though? Do pandas have claws?
I'd imagine older pandas might have claws. I mean, they're holding like bamboo, which is a tough fiber.
You're right, but as babies, they might just have the little like needle thing. You could deal with that. You could deal
yeah,
with
I can
any of those.
That. Yeah, I would just wear like thick leather chainmail or something before I went into the arena with the 20.
I like that you think you have thick leather chainmail.
Oh, I have a closet full. What's a favorite tradition that you have?
That is a good question. I don't know if I have a tradition.
Well, you need to go out and
what are some examples? What are some examples? You got to.
Okay. I don't do this anymore, but growing up, my family would go cut our own Christmas tree every year.
Mm-hmm.
That was great. It was horrible at the time as a kid, but it was an awesome tradition. Looking back,
mm-hmm.
Red Mill burgers on a Saturday afternoon at your secret beach spot every weekend or most weekends.
You know, so my kids are 9 and 6, so we're just starting to come up with some of these like you know, we've done it 3 or 4 years in a row. So I guess it's starting to be a tradition now. But one of the things we do is, I've got actually another one too, but one of the things that we've started doing is for Father's Day, we've been going on a hike. My dad, for whatever reason, that's one of the things he wanted to do on Father's Day. And especially with COVID, we started hiking a lot. Like when everything locked down, we would go out pretty much every Saturday or Sunday if it was nice out, and we'd just drive somewhere, you know, within an hour and a half or so of our house and just do a hike. So we're starting to do like the Father's Day hike is a cool tradition.
That's awesome.
The other one is for Mother's Day, we do Olive Garden. My wife, salad and breadsticks.
You know, unlimited salad and breadsticks.
You can't beat it. You can't beat it. And so during COVID, I reverse engineered the breadsticks. And then the grocery store in town has like a thing of Olive Garden salad dressing. So we've been doing salad and breadsticks at home now.
Olive Garden at home.
At home, yeah.
What makes you uncomfortable?
Teeth. My kids are losing their teeth and I can't go near them when they're doing anything with it.
Oh, like you mean like the
wiggling them
about to fall tooth?
No.
What about the tooth socket once the tooth has fallen out? Is that as disturbing to you?
That's okay. I'm not like, it's more just the teeth themselves.
The teeth themselves. So, you know, you would have no problem approaching the tooth socket, the fresh tooth socket, but the tooth itself.
I see what you're doing and I don't like it.
Just trying to understand.
Trying to get a rise out of me. No. I get it.
Are you a good driver?
Yes.
Prove it.
Right now? Perfect. Done. I'll be right back.
All right. Did you bring a pen and piece of paper?
I did.
All right. Greg Rubin, we're going to do the Somlight drawing challenge.
Oh, I am that part of my brain is missing. I cannot draw, but let's give it a shot.
Okay. We're going to have you draw for 45 seconds while telling us about, I'll give you an easy one then, since you just like, you know, feign like, oh, I can't draw.
No. You'll see. I really can't draw.
Okay. Well, let's see, but we'll test your wine knowledge at the same time. Right. So I'm going to give you a softball. Tell us about the wines of Champagne. For 45 seconds while drawing a jazz instrument of your choice.
Oh, okay. It's like a dissociation.
Yeah. Are you ready?
Distraction task. Okay.
Okay. Here we go. You have 45 seconds.
Great. The wines of Champagne are made preferably from nice limestone vineyards, and they are made with two fermentations. The first being usually in a vat, sometimes in large wood casks. The second being in the bottle, on lees. Three main grapes are Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Meunier. There's other grapes allowed. Oh my God, this is hilarious. And they're also not inexpensive either. It's not easy to make those wines and to sit on them for a bunch of years in your cellar. How am I doing?
You're doing great.
Oh, I've got more time. All right, great.
8 seconds left.
All right, cool. Oh my gosh.
Now you have 2 seconds left.
All right.
Now you are complete.
All right, you want to see?
Yeah. Can I guess what it's going to be? Oh, I knew it was going to be a saxophone. Oh.
With a note coming out of it.
And it's like an upside down note.
I don't know why I did an upside down note. That's just how it came out.
It's really, can you put it back up, please?
Sure.
You were so humble about showing
I'm
it.
I'm actually.
Ripping it right away. That's really good.
Impressed with myself that I got a little bit of third dimension on that.
Yeah, you know what it kind of looks like too, just to bring this like all the metaphors into one. It almost looks like a human figure jumping into an infinity pool, and that infinity pool is the world of jazz.
That's super deep.
You did it, Greg.
I dig it, man.
You did it. You drew this. You went there. Thank you for this philosophical deep exploration.
I'll tell you what else makes me uncomfortable: drawing.
Okay, last question. You know, you've been to Washington, you've met the winemakers, and you know, now you're back on the East Coast where you've got a lot of people that know European wines, that might know California wines. You know, you might say that Washington is maybe that ladder, right? Like you're moving people from something they know, like Napa or Bordeaux or whatever. Like, what are some of those? I love what you said earlier about, like, you have to edit down the nuggets of what you tell people. You can't tell them everything, right? You can't tell them about all the time, the things you know about Washington. But have you found there are certain nuggets and things that resonate with people that you tell them about Washington?
Yes. So there's a few things. If I kind of guess that somebody's more of a value buyer, meaning they're looking for a really good quality to price ratio, I'll usually hit on that of like, it's the vineyards in Washington are pristine. It's fair, like within reason, fairly easy to grow grapes there, as a non-grape farmer says. But you know, the grapes are healthy. The winemakers are knowledgeable. The wines are fantastic, and it's less expensive to make wine there than it is in Napa. So you can get a $45 Cabernet made exactly the same way as a Napa Cab that would cost $90 or $100. That's a really easy thing to tell people, and I feel completely confident in telling them that. You know, I make sure that I'm stocking good wines, right? Like great vineyards, great producers. Other things that I'll tell them. Washington it's starting to get into that kind of next generation of winemaking, where they've kind of figured, they've gone through the growing pains of figuring out what works where, and this clone or that clone, or how much, you know, how many vines per acre, or whatever, like yield, pruning, this, that, and the other thing. Do we blend in Syrah? Do we blend in Grenache? Like all this, you know, we're kind of there already. Now it's just trimming the edges, you know, and so. So I try to give people a sense of confidence around the fact that like you're getting Washington wines at a really great moment where the growing pains have all been worked out and the wines are really fantastic.
That's a great way to put it. I mean, that's really in a way where a lot of where we're at is also with the story too. Like the story is evolving now, and there's a lot of great stories that have cemented
and those are the stories I tell for the more like ensconced, more traditional wines from Washington that you would think of, you know, the DeLille's and the kind of, you know, Chateau Saint Michel, the kind of classic cabs and things like that. But even down at Vanderbilt Ave, when we work with smaller producers, it's still the same story, especially around like that next phase of things where you've got people like Andrew Latta, who made amazing wines with Charles Smith, and now he's doing some really interesting things with some really interesting grapes. Like the wines are fantastic. These vineyards are beautiful. Michael Savage, like all these people that are working with really interesting grapes from beautiful vineyards at a good price. So it's even true for the smaller producers where like, it's kind of that next wave of things that, you know, Napa and Sonoma kind of maybe saw 15 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's fair.
It's an easy story to tell. Like, I know I'm kind of literally preaching to the choir here, but it's a good story to tell people because A, it's true, and be the wines back it all up. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Greg. There you go. So appreciate all you do. I appreciate making time today. Stay well, stay healthy. This has been Somlight, and we'll catch you next time with some of our other favorite wine pros around the country. Thanks so much, Greg.
Cheers.
Cheers, buddy.